This is UUtah Phillips, the golden voice of the Great Southwest, and once again you're listening to Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind. From Howard Zinn. They want change but feel powerless, alone. Do not want to be the blade of grass that sticks up above the others and is cut down. They wait for a sign from someone else who will make the first move or the second, and at certain times in history, there are certain intrepid people who take the risk, that if they make that first move, others will follow, quickly enough to prevent their being cut down. And if we understand this, we might make that first move. Here we are back again on an extremely allergic day with a stuffy nose, but I don't mind. This is Seat of Your Pants Radio anyway. My name is Utah Phillips. With me is Steve Baker, who's twisting the knobs, pushing the dials, doing all that. Things that I don't know how to do. That, of course, was Hawks and Eagles. I never tire of introducing them because they're some of the finest musicians in North America. And you just heard a short piece from Howard Zinn. We are here at KVMR Community Radio, the last lost home of Audio Apocrypha, broadcasting from Nevada City, California, where truth rides hard and beauty ain't no camouflage. Well, where have I been lately? Went up to Butte, Montana. It was the dead of winter, a little bit better than 30 below zero, so cold you could freeze an egg on the sidewalk. Went up there to visit my old friend Mark Ross, who's the official troubadour of the National Hobo Association, one of the proud underwriters of this program, Loafer's Glory. Mark introduced me to a very interesting fellow by the name of John Driscoll. And John Driscoll is full of stories about old-time Butte, when Butte was the biggest city between Minneapolis and Seattle. Of course, it's way on hard times now because the underground mines are closed. And John Driscoll told me that there was a funeral parlor there in Butte called Dugan's. And that fell into the language. A Dugan became the rock that was going to kill you underground there. It to be Duganed is to be done in by one of the rocks. That's where you were carried afterward. John Driscoll had a big, big rock, big stone in his front yard. He called it the Lonely Dugan. He'd take his little boy out there and tell him stories about old Butte. Never told the boy about what Dugan really meant. When the kid asked, he said, well, Dugan is just a place where we come to tell stories to each other. Give you a song about those days. It comes from those days, sung by Mark Ross. The wrestling card, you applied for a job in the mines. You had to fill out a form and then wait for a couple of weeks while they did a research on you to make sure that you didn't belong to any union, you see. And if you came back with a clean bill of health, you get your rustling card, which meant you could get a job. A job on the hill, rustling the hill. Well, of course, that's the richest hill on earth, Butte, Montana, and one of the biggest open pit mines anywhere. It's all full of water right now. Let's listen to Mark Ross sing that old song, I Wandered Today.
I wandered today to the hill, Maggie, to get me a rustling card. I got both the card and the job, Maggie, but the job, it was too damned hard. Oh, the tunnel was filled with gas, Maggie, and the scope, it was fitchery as well. The rock come a-tumbling down on me, Maggie, and the shifter was crazier than hell. Thank you. once was a time in Butte, Maggie, when you could take five and hold your jaw. But now it's put the rock in the box, Maggie, and then put the waste in the gall. Oh, my brown hair has turned it to green, Maggie, from the water that seeps from the back. I'm the homeliest mug in the town, Maggie, and you'll soon want your maiden name back.
Mark Ross, I wandered a day to the hill, Maggie. Now let's see, where else have I been? Went down to Albuquerque, New Mexico, for the North American Folk Music and Dance Alliance. It's an enormous organization now. My wife and I were brought down there. Believe it or not, we were sponsored down there because we don't have any money. We were taken down there by the National Hobo Association, as I mentioned them earlier. And that we were flying down there, and they put us up in a hotel for about 5 days, gave us money, walking around money to eat on. Thought, my God, I have just mooched the tramps for better than $1,000 worth of goods and services, and that's got to be the pinnacle of any tramp's career. I don't think I'm ever going to better that. I may have the world's record. I don't know. We were very, very grateful to them for being able to do that, mainly because I don't travel much anymore, see, because of the heart problems. My extended family is out all over the country, places I've played for 30 years, homes that I've stayed in. If once a year, a great many of those come together in one place, so I have a chance to be with my family. And I mean, it's not like a business. It behaves like a family. Good people, dumb people, bad people, heroic people. And I loved being there among all of the people that I sometimes despair of ever seeing again. A lot of singing, a lot of people sharing music together. It's the old style, you know, when you do front porch music, backyard music, instead of going out and spending money and consuming it. I have only reluctantly been dragged kicking and screaming into the Second Industrial Revolution, and I eschew out of hand this sock full of puppy doo we have the audacity to call a culture. No rant control. One of the wonderful people that I met down there was Faith Petrick. Faith Petrick is 83 years old now. Just got back from 12 festivals in Australia. She's a dynamo, a powerhouse, founder of the San Francisco Folk Music Club that's been going for better than 30 years. She just put out a recording of her favorite songs, and third on the list is this song here, The Man Who Waters the Worker's Beer, Faith Petrick.
I care if it makes them ill, if it makes them terribly queer. I've a car and a yacht and an aeroplane, and I waters the workers' beer. When I makes the workers' beer, I puts in strychnine, some mentholated spirits, and a drop of iodine. But since a brew so terribly strong might make them terribly queer, I reaches out to the water spout, and I waters the workers' beer. I'm the man, the very fat man that waters the workers' beer. I'm the man, the very fat man that waters the workers' beer. And what do I care if it makes them ill, if it makes them terribly queer? I've a car and a yacht and an aeroplane, and I waters the workers' beer. A glass of brew is good for you when you're tired and thirsty and hot. I sometimes have a glass myself from a very special lot. But a fat and healthy working class is the thing that I most fear. So I reaches my hand for the water and can, and I waters the workers' beer. I'm the man, the very fat man that waters the workers' beer. I'm the man, the very fat man that waters the worker's beer. And what do I care if it makes them ill, if it makes them terribly queer? I've a car and a yacht and an aeroplane, and I waters the worker's beer. Oh, ladies fair beyond compare, be ye maid or wife, sometimes shed a tear for one who leads a sorry life. Water rates are shockingly high and malt is terribly dear, and there isn't the profit there used to be in watering the worker's beer. I'm the man, the very fat man that waters the worker's beer. I'm the man, the very fat man that waters the worker's beer. And what do I care if it makes them ill, if it makes them terribly queer? I've a car, a yacht, and an aeroplane, and I waters the worker's beer.
Isn't that a whale of a good song? Boy, they call her, Faith Petrick, the Fort Knox of folk music. She comes up with songs that people have forgotten about or never even knew existed to begin with. Faith Petrick is my idea of a folk singer. She doesn't make up songs, but what she chooses to sing out of this great hoard of people's music is phenomenal. Well, I was down there at Albuquerque and met a lot of people, singer-songwriters, young people who are trying to make a living at the trade, trying to get into it. Not a real good time to get into this trade because of there's too many people out looking for a diminishing pool of engagement, so the competition is ferocious. I think the cooperation beats the tar out of competition. People ought to team up and go together on these engagements. Most of them young singer-songwriters. I have no problem with the singer-songwriters, the new crop of them. I love the idea of people choosing song-making as a means of self-expression. And it doesn't even bother me all that much that the great many of the songs are highly personal, and sometimes things I would even feel uncomfortable sharing, especially in a public medium. What I'm concerned about is that the waning of the tradition. You know, our singer-songwriters during the 1960s, Bob Dylan, Tom Paxton, others, they were at folk festivals like Newport, but the elders were there, Roscoe Holcomb, Almeda Riddle, the traditional people, and the singer-songwriters could access that. And that's why Tom Paxton and Bob Dylan both wound up using traditional tune and verse models. And you know, that's why those songs are still being sung. For the most part, singer-songwriters today are writing signature songs. They're writing songs that only they sing. And they're not accessing the tradition because the elders have passed on or they've gone back home. Nobody knows where they are. I always want to encourage singer-songwriters to access this tradition, to become familiar with it, and if possible, include a couple of sing-along traditional songs in your shows because I think people would really appreciate it. Meanwhile, I did run into a group of four young people called Cordelia's Dad while I was down there. Now, these are young people who look like they could be a punk band, but they go out and track down this old music. They go and find the people who possess this old music, and that's what they do. I want you to hear a sample of the kind of music that they find. This is a song about a mill fire in the 1840s in Fall River, Massachusetts. Let's listen to Granite Mill, Cordelia's Dad. Thank you.
as she passed before my eyes. She was leaping out a window down from the roof so high. With a crack she fell down on the ground. She was bruised and burned and killed. 300 people lost their lives in the flames of the burning mill. Now it's my opinion, and it's my opinion still, they might all have been saved had the truth been told from the flames of the burning mill. One poor girl tried to escape by sliding down the rope, but when she got but halfway down, the burning strands they broke. I hope her soul has gone to rest in a place that's dearer still, above, above in heaven, above, far away from the burning.
Cordelia's Dad. A grim song. It's one of those songs from long ago that were the first to prick the American conscience and even begin to think, to consider the possibility of having safety regulations in those fire traps of mills. Reminds me, I don't want to get too grim about this, but I want to give you another song on that subject, only it's about 80 years later. Down there in Albuquerque, there was a couple of rooms there that had been rented out by Local 1000 of the American Musicians, AFM, the American Federation of Musicians. Local 1000 is a traveling musicians local. It's a non-geographic charter, which means you can join it, of our traveling nation, join it any place in the country. And for the first time, over-the-road traveling folk singers, you know, doing one-nighters from coast to coast, were able to access a pension plan, or able to get low-cost health insurance, which you never had before. And we really know what this union is for. Well, there was a room, and every night after 10:30, it was full of people, and they were all singing at the top of their lungs, beautiful, gorgeous, wide, deep harmonies. Well, on the plane coming down, I had a Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, and I found an obituary in it, and I clipped it out to take down there to talk to the people in 1000 about it. It was an obituary for Bessie Cohen. I'll read you a bit of it. Bessie Cohen, one of the last survivors of New York's infamous Garment District fire at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company almost 88 years ago, died Sunday. She was 107. The historic fire in the 10-story garment factory on Manhattan's Lower East Side killed at least 146 workers and prompted some of the first worker safety laws in the country. Reports of the Triangle fire claimed that exits to the building were sealed, either to keep seamstresses from stealing or to prevent union organizers from entering the building to foster a strike. Whatever the reason, many workers were trapped and died. Completing a 9-hour shift that March afternoon, Miss Cohen ran down 8 flights of stairs to escape. Bessie Cohen was a 19-year-old Jewish immigrant from Russia who had been in the United States for only 3 years. Her wages were $3 a week. Well, she lived all of her life with nightmares of the fire, of trips to the morgue to identify co-workers' bodies, and particularly of a friend's facial expression before she leapt to her death. Everybody was running, trying to get out, Mrs. Cohen told Los Angeles Times in 1996. And there was this beautiful little girl, my friend Dora. I remember her face before she jumped. Well, I got up to that Local 1000 room, the union I belong to, and I said, this is a good opportunity for me to find out. And I asked everybody, I said, are there any songs about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory? Well, wouldn't you know that the secretary treasurer of our local, John O'Connor, holds down the office back in New York. He had a song. He'd made a song. And that's what I want you to listen to, John O'Connor and Triangle Fire.
Come Come gather around and I'll sing you a song of a sight that I saw long ago. The weather was fair down in Washington Square. It was spring, I was on my way home. It was 1911 on March 25. I remember as if yesterday. At the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, where the girls were all waiting to pick up their pay. Fire was the cry from the windows up high. I saw, but I could not believe. Two girls on the ledge as they jumped from the edge into the arms of eternity. On the 8th and the 9th and the 10th floor, this factory of workers from the garment trade stuffed them into the rooms where so many were doomed at the end of the Sabbath day. Oh, the doors were all locked and the fire escapes weak. The whole building was a trap and a peril. Just to save a few bucks for the rich run amok, who made money from the lives of young girls. Fire was the cry from the windows up high. I saw, but I could not believe. Two girls on the ledge as they jumped from the edge into the arms of eternity. Choice for a young girl of 16 or so, but the sweatshops for the shirtwaist they sell. And what choice for a soul in a 10-story hole, but the pavement or the fires of hell? Now the question still looms in the workshops and rooms. The question, I'll pose it to you. When you stand to defend all the capitalists and their friends, what price for the profits of few? And murder I'll cry till the day that I die, for I saw but I could not believe. Two girls on the ledge as they jumped from the edge into the arms of eternity. To the arms of eternity.
That was John O'Connor, a song about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. Now there you have two songs there, sung by younger people. Younger people singing old songs or about older ideas. So that thread isn't completely unbroken, especially in the labor movement, especially among people who are really trying to make the world a better place to live and to work in. Triangle Shirtwaist, well, those mills did get organized. Those laws were passed under tremendous public pressure, dragging the boss kicking and screaming into agreeing with it. He had to go along with it. Of course, then the workers wound up getting a fair wage, wound up getting medical insurance that the boss was paying into, Social Security, pension funds, and so on. Got to be too expensive for the boss, didn't it? So what'd he do? He closed down those plants and moved to other countries in the world where those conditions exist today in factories that make the clothes that we wear, and a lot of it child labor. It was Big Bill Haywood, the founder of the Industrial Workers of the World, 1905. He said, "The worst thief is he who steals the playtime of children." But Bill Haywood also said, "World labor means a world union." Well, here's some younger folks singing an old song, an old Ralph Chaplin song, two young women called Rebel Voices. Let's listen to them singing Commonwealth of Toil.
When the earth is owned by labor, and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be, in the gloom of mighty cities amidst the roar of whirling wheels, we are toiling unlike chattel slaves of old. And our masters hope to keep us ever thus beneath their heels, and to coin our very life's blood into gold. But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when we all can live our lives secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be. They would keep us cowed and beaten, cringing meekly at their feet. They would stand between each worker and his bread. Shall we yield our lives up to them for the bitter crust we eat? Shall we only hope for heaven when we're dead? No, we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when we all can live our lives secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be. They have laid our lives up for us to the utter end of time. Shall we stagger on beneath their heavy load? Shall we let them live forever in their gilded halls of crime, with our children doomed to toil beneath their gold? No, we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when we all can live our lives secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be. When our cause is all triumphant and we claim our mother earth, and the nightmare of the present fades away, we will live with love and laughter, we who now are little worth, and will not regret the price we have to pay. 'Cause we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when we all can live our lives secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be.
Again, Blind Kenny Hall down in Fresno, as to an astonishing musician, an astonishing repertoire too. I guess Kenny must be getting close to 82. If you ever have a chance, go to Fresno. This is worthwhile making a hegira there and seeking him out. And don't forget to visit the Underground Gardens while you're there. One of my great teachers, one of my elders, was Jack Miller. Ran the Senior Citizen Center in Seattle, Washington for many years, but he was an organizer for the Industrial Workers of the World. He told me once, when he started in the forest, they spoke a dozen different languages. They were immigrant people. They could hardly understand each other. Said they didn't have intellectual lives. Most of them couldn't read or write. They lived, he said, we lived in our emotions, and we were at home there. We were able to make commitments to a struggle for which there were no words, but those commitments carried us through 50, 60 years of struggle. He said, you show me people who make the same commitments intellectually, and I don't know where they'll be next week. And he said, you know, we couldn't talk to each other, could hardly understand each other, but armed only with our sense of degradation as human beings, we came together and we changed the condition of our existence. Now, this is the hard part, he said. With all you've got today, why is it you young people can't do that? Why can't you do that? Let's just listen to a little bit of Jack Miller speaking for himself.
In the factories and in the mines, the mills and the plains, wherever work was done, that is where our fight was. We were fighting for better conditions. They could meet and pass all the damn laws they wanted to, see? But we would still stick to ourselves as working people, and we would do our legislating in the Union Hall.
Jack Miller. Well, young and old. I guess that's the theme that seems to be slowly developing through this foo-for-all. It's like one of those kitchen recordings made on a home recorder in George Mann's kitchen. Two people in New York City, George Mann must be close to 30, Julius Margolin is over 80, and they have come together as a duet to create and to share not only music from the past, but to make music for the picket lines today. Their faces are common faces wherever there's a labor action throughout the New York area. I'm going to play you one of Julius Margolin, the Elders, one of the songs, simple song he made up. You can sing along with this one. George Mann and Julius Margolin, young and old, we are the working class.
We are the working class. Yes, we are the working class. We are the working class. Our millions create the wealth. Without us, no trains would run. Without us, no trains would run. Without us, no trains would run. Our millions do the work. Without us, homes can't be built.
Homes can't and won't be built.
Without us, homes can't be built.
Homes can't and won't be built.
Without us, homes can't be built.
Homes can't and won't be built.
Our millions do the work.
The boss says,
try to starve us out. But we have a lot of clout. Our unions make us strong.
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 Our millions create the wealth. We are the working class.
We are the working class.
Yes, we are the working class.
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 Our millions create the wealth. And we're very proud of it.
Oh, that's delightfully simple. Just barely sketching with words, but they're all the right words, you know. George Mann and Julius Margolin made that song up, the old socialist. Yeah, socialism, the Socialist Party was founded in Milwaukee. They're at Turner's, the old Turnverein, the German Athletic Club. I've been in that restaurant and sat in that booth, right where Eugene V. Debs sat, and ate his steak tartare and founded the Socialist Party of America. They had their first convention, I guess it was back in Chicago. Meanwhile, down in southern Utah, there was a fellow named Charlie Kelly. He wrote books that he couldn't publish because they had some unfortunate things to say about the Mormon Church, so he built a printing press and he printed it himself. Well, he had a little farm down there, Charlie Kelly did. The adjacent farm was one of the apostles of the Mormon Church, Amasa M. Lyman. And they were both fascinated when they read in the newspaper about this new thing, the Socialist Party Convention. But only one of them could afford to take the train back east to that convention. So they drew straws, and Charlie Kelly won, on the guarantee that when he came back, he would tell Amasa everything there was to know about socialism. Charlie went to the convention, came back on the train, got back down to the farm. That's around Torrey, Utah. Amasa came over and said, "Well, now, Charlie, what is this about socialism?" And Charlie said, "Well, near as I can tell, socialism means that if I had, that half everything that I have, half of it belongs to you." Amasa said, "Charlie, does that mean if you had two houses, one of them would be mine?" He said, "Oh, yeah, that's what it means. If you had two barns, one of them would be mine?" "Yeah, that's right, one would be yours." "Charlie, if you had two hogs, one of them would belong to me?" Charlie said, "Damn it, Amasa, you know I've got two hogs." Yeah, socialism. Young people singing new music. One of the people that was there in that local 1,000 room down in Albuquerque was from Cleveland, Ohio, the land of my nativity, a woman named Deborah Van Cleef. And she made this song up about a fast food strike, one of the first I ever heard of, down in Macedonia, Ohio, and it can't be much more than a year old. Let's listen to the great fast food strike, Deborah Van Cleef.
Come all you fast food workers, wherever you may dwell, if you'll consent to listen, a story I will tell of six young workers like yourselves who were compelled to go and labor for McDonald's in Macedonia. 'Twas in Northeast Ohio this burger franchise stood, as in many such establishments conditions were not good. The wages they were meager, but by far the greatest woe was to work for Jerry Guffey in Macedonia. Now Jerry was the manager, a spiteful man was he. If ever you displeased him, his anger you would see. With foul names and shoves and shouting, his curses they would flow. He was the meanest fast food boss in Macedonia. And Margaret, she was 66, she worked from need not choice. One day she left a bag of trash out of its proper place. When Jerry came upon it, his rage did overflow. The staff looked on as Margaret wept in Macedonia. T'was on an Easter Sunday, student workers made a vow. Abuse of youth and elderly no longer will allow. These brave young people left their jobs, their paychecks did forego, to walk upon a picket line in Macedonia. Now Brian Drapp walked out, Jamal Nickens he did too. Josh Jones and Matt Casserly, they joined the picket crew. Steve Stem and Heidi Schaefer, solidarity did show. They led the fight for dignity in Macedonia. From CNN to Leno, Howard Stern to NPR, the story of the fast food strike was carried near and far. McDonald's high executives, to save the status quo, sent in a crack consultant to Macedonia. Then Teamsters Local 416 came to the strikers' aid. These kids against your corporate might's an unfair fight, they said. We're here to balance out the scales, the company said no. We will not talk with unions in Macedonia. At Route 8 and the interstate, the strikers held their ground. They thrust aloft their picket signs as the April rains beat down. Till a Teamster bakery driver, he dealt the final blow. He would not cross a picket line in Macedonia. The bosses watched in horror as the truck it rolled away. They knew it carried all the buns they needed for that day. While 20 cheering picketers still marching to and fro saw victory within their grasp in Macedonia. A fair wage and paid vacations, better safety at the grill. In every point of bargaining, the workers had their will. And to a training program, Jerry Guffey's forced to go to brush up on his people's skills in Macedonia. You've heard of labor struggles in Harlan's bloody hills, at Homestead, Flint, and Ludlow, and in Massachusetts mills. In April 1998, the history books will show how fast food workers held the line in Macedonia.
Isn't that a grand song? Don't you wish all the young people in high school could hear songs like that and learn from them, that you don't have to put up with the whatever the boss tries to ram down your throat, that you can organize, you can change the condition of your labor, the condition of your life. So many people are afraid to join the working class because it's so badly stigmatized. That word redneck, I hate that word redneck. You get a redneck from bending over in the hot sun and working hard. The people who do the work of the world. I mean, the people who run the sewage treatment plant, who deliver my mail, who pick up the garbage and take it away. All things I can't do myself. They add more to my quality of life than I do to theirs. And that's a plain fact of it. But it stigmatizes the great unwashed, and people don't want to identify themselves as working class. Judy Berry, one of the greatest organizers I ever met, organized for Earth First and for the industrial workers of the world. She passed on not too long ago. She was the one whose car got blown up with her in it and was seriously injured. I want you to listen to what Judy Berry has to say about that. This is her speaking before she passed away, how to organize timber workers. Judy Berry.
What everybody has been asking me for the last 2 days is, like, how do you organize timber workers? How do you organize loggers? How do you get loggers to talk to Earth Firsters? And the first answer is you have to like loggers. That's the first thing. And I already did, because, you know, I, having been a blue-collar worker my whole adult life, the conditions of my life are actually more similar to them than to the privileged environmentalists in the city. So the espresso-sucking pavement dwellers, as we call them. But so being from a rural area myself and being a working-class person myself, I can relate for those reasons. But a lot of it really depends on your attitude. And the thing that happens is people who are more educated or who are from urban areas tend to really look down, especially on rural working people. And actually what I've discovered from a lifetime of being a non-achiever is that intelligence is not, it's equally distributed among the social classes. Dan Quayle is the perfect example of that. But there's a tendency of urban people to look down and consider the timber workers stupid, to talk down to them, to things like that. I've heard a 21-year-old college student say to a 45-year-old logger, "Do you know what biodiversity is?" And, you know, if you do that, that's the end of the conversation. So what I actually do is I just talk to people, that's all. I mean, it's been incredibly easy because there's nobody speaking for the timber workers out there. The wise use movement, the anti-environmentalists, those people are management. In fact, if you actually know them and who they are low-level management. They're fronting for the corporations, but they're not the workers. Nobody's speaking for the workers. The unions have mostly been smashed or corrupted themselves, and the actual interest of the workers is not expressed in the political spectrum in the timber wars. So what I did was, well, one of them is having some respect for them as intelligent human beings. Instead of telling the timber workers what to do, which is the other mistake environmentalists always make, I asked them. And I asked them to tell me about their working conditions and their lives. And the way I would meet them, by the way, is we'd blockade them. And, you know, here they are, and we're chained to their truck. They're not going anywhere. And, and that actually is really how I started meeting timber workers. And, you know, they're kind of curious about these people who are audacious enough to actually hike into the middle of nowhere in the woods and put their bodies on the line. You know, timber workers tend to be curious, and the cultural difference doesn't really bother them that much. You know, that's another object of curiosity. It's more just our attitudes towards them. So as I began to hear their stories, and I didn't even do this consciously, I began to give them a forum. I began to use my access to the locally radical newspapers to, you know, interview them and write about their conditions and what they told me. I used my radio access. I work on KZYX in Mendocino County, one of KBOO's sister stations, and I would, you know, bring the loggers on and stuff like that. So by listening to them, by asking them instead of telling them, I really not only learned a lot of wisdom from them, but also began to build this alliance by advocating for the timber workers' issues in the community. And it didn't have to be save the trees. I advocated for workplace issues separately, understanding that it's the same thing, you know, that the workplace issues are neither separate from nor subordinate to the forest issues. They're all part of corporate exploitation of the earth and the people.
Wow, yeah, isn't it? That's just plain good advice, folks. You know, you pay attention to that. I was driving south to Washington, D.C. with Kate Wolfe and Shay Greenwood. We were going to sing down there. I was going to be singing at a Karen Silkwood rally in a little park behind the White House, sponsored by the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union. Kate in the back seat said, "Well, what is this we're going to?" So I passed her all the flyers and literature information and letters that I'd gotten from the union, and she read them while we were getting there. They had the rally. I sang. Toward the end, Kate walked up and said, "Would they mind if I sang?" Kate was never known really as a capital P political singer, you know, and the organizer of the rally said, "Sure," and Kate got up on the stage and she sang a song that she had made up in the back seat while we were driving down from Philadelphia out of the stuff that I'd hand her and also the things that we'd been singing and talking about down the road. Here's a rare recording of that song I got from Che Greenwood, Kate Wolfe and Links on the Chain.
It's just another link in the chain, just another link in the chain, the truth growing stronger, voices speaking louder, it makes us links in the chain, try it. It's just another link in the chain, just another link in the chain, the truth growing stronger, voices speaking louder, that makes us links in the chain. Willing to go ahead when other people were afraid, remembered by the questions that they raised, some dead and some in prison for the things that they believe. They're all links in the chain. just another link in the chain, just another link in the chain, truth growing stronger, voices speaking louder, makes us links in the chain. Who took the children from the mines, the young women from the mills, when the bosses turned to look the other way? It was the rebel voices raised against the wind who fought for the rights we have today. It's just another link in the chain, just another link in the chain, truth growing stronger, voices speaking louder, that makes us links in the chain. And it's the questions and the answers, the knowing and the why, standing up to the wrong things that we see. And it takes more than one before the battle's won, someone else who's not afraid to be. Last time, just another link in the chain, just another link in the chain, truth growing stronger, voices speaking louder, that makes us links in the chain.
As Kate Wolf, my old friend, it occurs to me that a lot of this music that I've been playing is certainly well-meant, but a bit polite. I don't like to be polite all the time. Let's close it out with one of my favorite labor songs done by a bunch of rowdies, trade unionists all in Portland, Oregon, to get together, have a few cocktails, and then roar. They call themselves General Strike, and they are the ones who are leading the banzai charge on the upper crust, which, as you know, is a handful of crumbs held together by a wad of dough. General Strike, go to hell, rotten bosses.
We join hands.
We join hands
with Joe Hill,
Joe Hill,
Ralph Chaplin, and Florence Reese. Stand together in this fight for our rights. Hear our song.
Hear our call.
Equal rights for workers all. And go to hell, rotten bosses, go to hell. Well, I was alone. So I picked up my telephone.
Who'd you call?
And I called my union hall.
What'd you tell them?
Said I'm tired of this shit. I'm fed up, and you know I've had it. So go to hell, rotten bosses, go to hell.
If at work you feel beat, fight back, get off your seat. Rally behind your union's banner. The boss plays golf in Palm Springs, pays politicians to wreck our dreams.
So go to hell, rotten bosses, go to hell.
Thanks for being with us on this little journey. My name is Utah Phillips, and you've been listening to Loafer's Glory, the Hobo Jungle of the Mind. This little fragment for all you singers of the tradition, from Quetzalcoatl 1,000 years ago. Who will have me? Who would be with me? Here I stand. Will you take me? I am a singer. My fragrant songs, my flowers, fall like strewn petals in the presence of others. I weep as I speak. I cry my soul. Would that I might see the song root. Would that I might transplant it. Would that it might grow on earth when it comes. Let it come, a remembrance of me, that my name might endure.